Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Well, as I was saying, when Arthur Blank bought the Falcons, we
that was the last thing I heard from you, Bobby.
Well, I thought I'd bored you so bad y'all dove off the bridge or something.
I said I had enough of this. I'm out.
I don't know what happened. The switchboard just went dead. A couple of people that were listening said they could hear me asking for you guys, but didn't hear any response. So hopefully we'll get through our show tonight without the same problem. But I have to tell you, Bobby, I sat here and watched that game, and I was pulling for them, but they just couldn't book two big comebacks in a row, 2 weeks in a row.
Yeah, like I say, I've been down that road before. I wanted them to win, but I wasn't terribly disappointed. I mean,
when you have a team down 22-0 and then 17-0, you know, it's hard to come back on, but I don't know.
I don't know.
They got a good booker is all I can say. Well, me and Debbie had a discussion, and if the Falcons had won, I was not going to be able to go to Cauliflower Alley this year. I was going to go to the Super Bowl. And I couldn't go to both, so I had to make a choice. So they helped me decide to go to Cauliflower Alley. So I confirmed my Delta flights today. So I guess I'm gonna be spending the week with Mr. Smith in April.
Oh Lord!
Well, it's a fun-filled week. You have to learn. The thing you learn when you stay with Charlie is you do not talk directly to Charlie. You talk to the hearing aids that are laying on the table that he won't wear, and you hope it filters through.
I tell you, he was down here 2 weeks ago, and he came down for, he claimed he came down for the Gulf Coast reunion, our meeting. We had a board meeting at Bob Kelly's house, and he claimed he was down here for that, but what he was actually down here was to deliver some goods to Joe Turner and collect some money. So
I knew there had to be some money involved.
So he stayed at the Red Roof, and I picked him up early on Saturday morning. And Charlie, to give you a little backstory, Jerry, you've ridden with Klondike Bill in the past, right?
Oh, yes, sir, I have.
Well, Charlie has long told this story about the first time he rode with him, said he was blue by the time he got back to Atlanta, wherever they were going from. And so when I picked him up at 8 o'clock on Saturday morning, which is unusual for Charlie to be up at 8 o'clock anyway, he normally sleeps till noon. I need to pick him up early because we went over to Pensacola and picked up Bill Bowman and then came back. But anyway, I picked him up. And as a rib, it was cool that morning. It was probably upper 30s, low 40s. I had the air conditioning going full blast and the windows down when he got in my car. And that's the first thing he said, "Wait a minute, I turn that air conditioning off." I said, "No, sir, we're going just like it is with the windows down and the air conditioning going all the way to Pensacola." "Well, I'm not going there."
Well, I got a question for Mr. Oates.
What's that, sir?
My buddy Tom Stevenson sent me an article out of the Athens newspaper that said that the island people down there said they were having a coyote hunting or something. So I guess I'm wondering, are you now a coyote expert?
What do you want to know about them? We found him dead on the beach about 10 days ago. Somebody shot him during the night.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Well,
of course, nobody's going to admit to doing that.
Yeah.
But and I hope that was the only one.
I was going to say, was there just one?
Bobby, that was the only one I had ever seen.
Yeah.
I mean, it was the same markings every time I saw him. But, you know, somebody said there was a gray one. There was a, oh, you know. But that was the only one I'd seen.
We got them in Buckhead.
I'm sure you do.
They're getting cats and dogs and stuff in Buckhead. People are afraid to let their pets out by themselves.
It's how they migrated down in here, I don't know. They're all over Chatham County.
Hmm.
We haven't had any reports on, you know, attacking a human.
Yeah. Whew. That's kind of scary.
And he'd run that beach at night like he owned it.
Huh.
Well, at night he probably did.
He did.
Unless he ventured too close to the water and he'd end up being shark food.
We had, I think New Year's Day, we had two great whites out there.
Well, I was fixed to say, I was going to bring that up, too. I read an Atlanta paper. They said they marked them or tagged them up off the
GPS's on them.
Massachusetts
or
something.
That, I don't know.
They said one of them was 22 feet long and weighed 3,500 pounds, and the other one was a little shorter and only weighed about 2,500.
Can you imagine that, Bobby?
I can't imagine me being out there with them.
Well, people say, you know, those things don't come this, you know, south like this. They go anywhere they want to go.
Yes, sir.
They would have to go,
and you can think, as large as those were, they were probably 300 or 400 years old. Those things have probably been around forever.
There's no telling.
Since George Washington was a baby. Since Charlie Smith was a baby.
Oh, goodness.
I'm not going out there. I mean, they catch them all the time. Where most of them fish, not right where all the swimmers are, but that don't mean anything. They catch 6-foot sharks. I'm not going out there. I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah, I seen that in the paper here in Atlanta about them two great whites they were tracking. I called my wife and I said, "You laugh at me because I say I won't go out in the ocean." I was talking to a buddy of mine a couple of days ago, and he said he's like me. He said he don't like it either. He said, but he went on vacation with his kids a few years ago, and he said he got real brave and he waded out about shoulder deep, and he was out there playing with his kids, and he said something hit his leg, and he said he was from shoulder deep to the beach in like half a second. And he said when he got up on the beach, he looked down and a piece of seaweed had wrapped around his leg. He said he thought something had him.
Well, he sounds like me.
Oh.
I'd be the same way. That would be the same way. Well, since we were last on the air, and as I always have to do this, we have lost four from our brotherhood. One, actually, we lost last year, but we didn't find out about it until... Well, nobody was never let out until last week. His family waited until everything was settled. He actually died in November of last year, or of 2012. I mean, it was last year, but when I say last year, it makes it sound like the year before last. But and that was Don Arnold. I don't know if either one of you were familiar with him. He mainly worked Southwest. Was a big name, big star out in Arizona, Texas, West Texas. Finished up his career in L.A. in the mid-70s, working under a hood, and was a very interesting person. The reason he worked under a hood in California, he was also a full-time school teacher and high school coach in San Diego, which is where he was from. So he worked under the hood and taught during the day. But he was also a PhD, I don't know if you can be a professional, but he was a nudist. In fact, he wrote a book on how to properly be a nudist, which I thought it was taking your clothes off. I guess there's more to it than that.
I got a PhD.
Oh, me.
A pair of post hole diggers out here in my garage. I don't know how to operate them, but I got them.
I don't know if his PhD was in nudism or not. But if he was a if he was a PhD in nudism, Don Fargo's got to have his doctorate in it by now. But Don Arnold was he was 89 years old.
Good Lord.
So yeah, he was up there. Like I said, he died November 22nd of 2012 in Hawaii, which is where he was living with his daughter at the time. And I guess the family didn't want anybody to know until
they got some clothes on him.
Yes, I guess. But anyway, another person died a couple weeks ago. Billy Guyot, who was as Billy the Kid, the midget wrestler. And Billy was 76 years old, and he was back in Louisiana, which is where he was from. Did either one of you guys ever work around him or with any shows with him?
Not that I know of.
He was around a long, long time. And
I worked with so many of them. I don't remember who all I did and didn't.
Another one we lost was Robert Perret, who worked as the Marquis de Paris and Monsieur Guillotine. He mainly worked in the upper Midwest, Minnesota, up that way, and Canada. And then just this morning, we lost Tito Montez, who was another big name out in Arizona.
Nice
Bobby,
guy.
Did you meet him out and you met
nice.
Him at Dean's?
Super nice guy. I met him at Dean Silverstone's. When I went out for the one time I got to go to the reunion out there, had a chance to sit and talk to him. Real nice guy.
Have not been able to find his age. He had to been. He started wrestling in 53,
so I would
think
he was
in
his
80s.
Had to be up there. Yeah.
But an interesting thing about him was he was from Arizona, around Phoenix. Benny Hazar was also from Phoenix. Came along a decade later. Both of them worked under the name Eddie Sullivan. Both of them worked for Dean Silverstone as Eddie Sullivan.
Yeah.
Both of them worked at Arizona as Eddie Sullivan. Both of them worked in Mobile as Eddie Sullivan.
Yeah.
But a decade apart. So, but anyway, I always hate to have to pass on that stuff, but it's been nonstop for the last couple months, it seems like. But at least these gentlemen lived good, full lives and didn't leave us too early. So, but anyway, we are going to be joined by our special guest, Jody Hamilton, here in just a few minutes. So I'm going to take a break real quick. When we get back, I'll get Jody on the line with us, and we'll see what he can tell us about everything.
All right.
Take a quick break.
Wrestling fans, Anarchy Wrestling television tapings are the second and fourth Saturdays of every month at 4236 Level Grove Road in Cornelia, Georgia. For more information on Anarchy Wrestling and on the shows, to watch the television product and a whole lot more, go to anarchy-wrestling.net. That's Anarchy Wrestling, the second and fourth Saturdays of every month in Cornelia, Georgia.
If you're hurt, get the money you deserve. If you're in pain, get the money you deserve. At Terry and Peterman, we're personal injury attorneys who take a professional, thorough approach to your accident and injury claims. Don't call some long-distance law firm or satellite office. Don't trust your claim to just anyone. For a free consultation, call the law office of Terry and Peterman today, 229-247-0386, or go online at www.terryandpeterman.com. The law offices of Terry and Peterman, making things right.
Whether you're having an autograph session, personal appearance, or live event, we got just the person you need to contact for all of those needs. SBI Bookings is home of some of the best stars in the wrestling industry today. They provide you with the best talent this business has to offer, from Kevin Nash, Larry Zbysko, Scott Steiner, and many, many more. So who will you contact next time you're planning an event? The men of SBI Bookings. Check them out at sbibookings.com.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Ray Gunkel or Gordon Soley? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first party you attended? Who was it under that mask?
Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? That happened in Columbus on my birthday. Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past, or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
I'm going to dial up.
Michael, before you do that, I just wanted to, we got a, me and Debbie had a, to us, it was a major tragedy this week, and I've got a lot of phone calls and cards and letters and emails, and I just wanted to thank everybody that that thought about us and sent a little note. If folks here don't know what I'm talking about, it may seem silly to you if you're not a pet lover, but we lost our, we called her baby cat. We lost her Tuesday morning about 1:27. She died in Debbie's arms and me sitting here petting her. And we'd had her 20 years and 3 months.
Lord.
And
she was a great cat.
It was like losing our kid. And we're just.
People have no idea, Bobby, what that's like.
Well, geez, I have cried for 3 days. I'll think about something and I'll, I mean, it's just. It's been tough on us, but we just a lot of people expressed some sympathy, and I just wanted to thank everybody for listening out there. It meant a lot to us. And this too shall pass. We'll get over it, but she was a great part of our lives.
As most people know, I since I've been back in Mobile, whenever I go up to Atlanta, most of the time I would stay with Bobby and Debbie. And the first couple of years I stayed with them, they were talking about baby cat. If you see baby cats, you know, don't, you know. And I kept thinking they were pulling my leg or something because I never saw the one cat. So finally, about 2 years ago, she just appeared out of nowhere and jumped in my lap. First person that I guess I was around long enough.
You were the first person's lap she ever jumped into.
She finally accepted me as family. He ain't going anywhere. He's not going to go away, so I might as well pay him attention.
Yeah.
Pay attention to him. So, but she, what a sweet cat. She was wonderful. And I know just exactly how you guys feel. I lost my dog 2 years ago that I'd had for 15 years, and it was, you guys were braver than me. I couldn't have been there to the end. I mean, I got up and took one look at him and knew I had to get him out of his misery and took him up to the vet. I sat there and held him for an hour before I gave him to him.
Well, she never drew a hard breath. She never had any kind of little seizure or hiccup or anything. She just she made a funny sound. Debbie heard her. We got up. When I got to her, she looked up at me. She was laying on her side. She looked up at me. I picked her up, laid her in Debbie's lap, and we just sat down with her because we knew. We just knew, and you know, it took 2 or 3 minutes, and she just quit. She just went to sleep. She never, I mean, it was not bad. I mean, it was bad as what it was, but as far as just her going away, she never suffered, and we're so thankful for that. But anyway, y'all get
me
crying.
She had a good home for a lot of years.
Yeah, she was spoiled rotten. Me and Debbie have no regrets. We did everything we could to make her life comfortable, and we still have Punk. He'll be 14 in April, and Baby Cat was never over 8 pounds in her whole life, and Punk's about 20 pounds, and he looks like a land manatee, and he just kind of lumbers around.
He does the best Burt Reynolds imitation of any cat I've ever seen. He's posing for Playboy.
Just plays it out there, son.
Oh, man. You guys have certainly been in my thoughts and prayers this week, because, like I said, I know it's like I still look for my dog. I still think sometimes I hear him.
Well,
but
yeah,
anyway.
This sounds strange, and I don't mean to trivialize other people's losses, and I know human loss is a great thing, but you know, I've not only did I lose a good part of my life the other night, I had a funeral at 11 o'clock the next morning, and I think it was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. I mean, I just, it was tough going, you know, in the state it was in, and then I've got another one tomorrow night. So it's been a real long week.
Well, good. You need the show to get your mind off stuff.
Yes.
So. Well, let's call Mr. Hamilton.
We'll get a Magic Jack commercial. I'm hanging up.
You won't get your cut if you do that.
Hello?
May I speak to Jody, please?
Who's calling? Oh, just a minute, please.
Okay.
Jody, you're calling him.
He was waiting on it.
Ms. Rosemary.
Okay. Yes, it is.
This is Bobby Simmons. I just wanted to say hey before you handed it to him.
Well, hi, Bobby. It's been a long time since
yes.
I heard your voice.
Yes, it has. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I really
good.
Am.
Good. You're on the radio. And by the way, for those of y'all that don't know this is Jody's wife of many years, and she's actually the one that runs the house. He just tells everybody he does.
You know, Bobby, that's true.
I know it is.
He'll be with you in just 1 minute.
All righty.
Thank you, ma'am.
That's a sweetheart of a lady, my boys.
I can imagine so.
I know he lives in Griffin. He must be walking in from the outhouse.
Now, you trying to get heat with him already.
I've never known him late for a booking. Well, anyhow, Bobby, who's going to win the Super Bowl?
You know, for some reason, I just think the Ravens might pull this thing out.
Do you really?
Well, it's Ray Lewis's last game, and if it is work, I mean, what better way to go out?
That's right.
I mean, I don't know. I just...
Hello.
Hello there.
How are you?
I'm good.
All right,
sir.
How you doing, Jody? We've got Jerry Oates, Bobby Simmons on with us.
Oh, great.
Peace to have good morning. How are you this evening?
Pretty good, pretty good.
Good. Bobby said you were outside feeding the cows. Is why you...
Yeah, I'm milking them.
Well, I'm glad you were a minute late. I had a chance to speak to your lovely bride. I haven't seen her in a long time. And I explained to these two gentlemen with me here that that's really who runs your house. You just tell everybody you do.
Oh, I don't even tell that. I quit telling that lie years ago.
Well, you need to have a talk with Charlie Smith. He still tells it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Everybody that knows Charlie Smith knows Louise wears the pants in that family. Oh, man. Well, Jody, how are you doing this evening?
Doing all right. Doing all right for an old man.
Good. I hear you. We all are that way. I was wondering, I know you spent some time out in Arizona. Did you know either Don Arnold or Tito Montez? Did you ever work with either one of them?
Who was that?
Don Arnold or Tito Montez?
Oh, yeah, I knew both of them, yeah.
Don passed away back in November, but his family just let people know last week.
Oh, really?
I don't know if you've heard that, yeah.
No, I haven't.
He was 89 years old, and Tito died this morning.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, he's had Alzheimer's pretty bad for the last couple
of years. Were they still living in Arizona?
Well, no, Don was in Hawaii with his daughter, and Tito, I think, was in Portland or Seattle, somewhere in the Northwest. He was no longer in Arizona, but I didn't know. I was telling them Don Arnold was a PhD, and he also wrote a book on nudism, and I don't know if his PhD was in or not.
didn't know Don very well. He was he was kind of a hard guy to get to know, you know.
Yeah.
And we weren't rivals by any means or anything, but it was just like I say, he was a hard guy to get to know and everything. And during the period of time that I was exposed to him, that was kind of an inappropriate word to use since he was, wrote a book on nudism, right? Exposed to him.
Well, maybe you were, Joe.
But let me rephrase that. At the time that that I was around him, Don, not being a overly warm, overly friendly guy, and everything, although I got along with him just fine and everything, but he would just, he never, to my knowledge, he never allowed anybody to get really that close to him anyway, so.
Yeah.
But, you know, like I say, I got along fine with him. He was all right.
Let's talk a little bit about your, go ahead, Jerry.
Is that where you knew him, Jody, in Arizona?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was a
Arizona and also L.A.
Was Arizona a territory unto itself?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was back then, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, Ernie Mohammed had it.
Yeah, there was a couple of people. I know at one time parts of Arizona were up under the Funks promotion out of Amarillo, but there was, before Ernie Mohammed, Buddy Fuller tried to run it for a while. He didn't last maybe a year or two, if that long.
No, he didn't last a year.
Really? And then I think after Mohammed was Rod Fenton, wasn't it, Jody? Or was he?
No, no. Rod Fenton was there. He was the original.
Oh, was he?
Oh, yeah. Rod Fenton had been there for, he and, God, I can't think of the other, I can't think of his partner's name. But there was Rod and his partner had Arizona for years, and then his partner decided to retire, and they did real well with it. But his partner decided to retire, and Rod ran it by himself for a while, which was a disaster waiting to happen. And then Rod left and went up to Vancouver, started running Vancouver.
Okay.
I worked for him up there, too.
Really?
I worked for Rod Fenton up there.
Jody, I may have the story wrong, but I think you told me this, or maybe Tom told me. Didn't you guys go to Arizona? The guy that contacted you to go out there, and you guys didn't really want to go, and you told the guy that you give him some off-the-wall guarantee that you thought he wouldn't meet, the guy wrote him back and said, yeah, we'll give it to you, so you wound up going, you stayed a year or something?
Yeah. Yeah, that was that's pretty close to accurate there.
Well, I can't remember if you told
we
me.
Were in, we were in Tulsa at the time, and we were getting ready to leave, and hadn't really made up our mind where we were going to try to go, but Mohammed called and wanted us to come out there, and we'd heard he was kind of a dippy guy, you know, so. We didn't really want to go to Arizona, but you know, back at it, we got a $450 a week guarantee apiece, which was that was big money back then in those days, you know. And what the hell, he was only well, let's see, how did that work now? We worked. On Monday, we worked. On Monday, we worked Phoenix. We did a TV show in Phoenix. On Tuesday, we worked Tucson. On Friday, we worked a house show back in Phoenix. And then on Saturday, we worked a little town about 30 miles away called Casa Grande. And that was it. The rest of the time we were off. so we were making good money, and not working. We weren't getting overworked as it was, you know. So we ended up enjoying our store, our stay out there. Of course, that's when Tom ended up there towards the end of our run there. Tom contacted infectious hepatitis, and he had to take a lot of time off. And I stayed there probably another 6 to 8 weeks, maybe 2 months after Tom, while Tom was recuperating and so on. And then I left, and believe it or not, I went back to my hometown, St. Joe, for a while. And that's the Gorgeous George Jr. was out there at the time. He was like getting started in the business in Phoenix, and he wanted to get out of there. So I took George back to. I got George booked in St. Joe along with me, and I had him drive my second car back, my wife's car back to St. Joe for us. In fact, he stayed with us down in the basement apartment there. I was staying at my brother's house because Larry was out on the road, and George was staying in the basement apartment that he had in the house and everything. He stayed with us for a while.
I was going to bring up Gorgeous George Jr. Later on in the show, but now's as good a time as any. We had George on just a few short months before he passed away. He was on our show, and Bobby has related these two stories, having heard them from you, and he had George tell his version of them, and we're going to hear directly from horse's mouth about the time that you scared George so bad about a snake that he nearly killed himself. And then
well, George, he wasn't working every night out there, and on the nights that he did work, he didn't make much money and everything, so he was having to really watch his money, you know. So he kind of latched on to me and Tom, and I kind of liked the guy. So he used to ride with us, and then this is when during the period of time when Tom was recuperating from hepatitis and everything, George rode with me. He got a few more bookings and so on, and he was booked basically every night that I was booked. So, on the way back from Tucson, we used to cut through the back way up through Casa Grande that way. That was the old back way up through the Indian Reservation. And that road was literally, at nighttime, was literally crawling with snakes and rattlesnakes. The majority of them were rattlesnakes. So I had a new 98 Oldsmobile convertible at the time, so what we'd do is we'd put the top down, and instead of getting out, we'd drive real slow, you know, 5-10 miles an hour, and we'd see these snakes on the side of the road and everything, and when it started cooling off at night and everything, they would crawl up on the asphalt because the asphalt held its warmth more so than the sand did. So they'd crawl up there on the asphalt, and of course when they felt the vibration of the car coming, they'd start to crawl off and everything. But I'd honk the horn and blink the lights and everything, and that'd startle them, and they'd stop and coil up and everything. So I'd put the car in the park, and I'd ease up, and I'd sit on the top of the front seat, the driver's seat, and shoot out over the top of the windshield. And we were shooting rattlesnakes that way, you know. So one night we saw this huge, long, snake had to be, my God, without exaggeration, crawling across the road, the snake had to be 6 feet long, okay? So I said, look at the size of that one. I honked the horn and blinked the lights, and boy, he coiled up. So I eased the car in the park, and I slid my hind end up on the back of that seat, and I went out, shot out over the top of the windshield and everything, and I popped him. He went and I hit him with a .45 automatic, and the slug of that .45 hit him, and even as big as he was, he went up in the air and did a flip and came down, and George says, I've got to get those rattlers, because he figured there had to be about a dozen rattlers on that thing. So I said, okay. So I said, just be careful. I says, I'm not sure which end I shot. So he gets out, and he's sneaking up on the side of the car and looking at that dead snake. Of course, the snake is still wiggling a little bit, you know, not knowing that. And I wasn't sure either, because it was dark and kind of shadowy, even with the headlights on and everything. But I had shot the snake's head off. So George was easing up there, and just as he reached down to pick up that snake and cut the rattlers off his tail, he had set a pack of cigarettes on my dashboard. And I reached up and I grabbed that pack of cigarettes, and just as he bent over, I threw that pack of cigarettes and I hit him right square in the butt. At the same time, I honked a horn. I have never seen a human being jump that high in my life. And he screamed and let out a bloody murder scream while he was jumping. And when he came back down, he was prone over the hood of my car, and I thought, and he laid there. And I said, my God, I wondered if the snake bit him. So I called out. I wasn't about to get out there and walk around on that thing with all them snakes out there. And I said, George, I said, you all right? And after about 30 seconds, he finally answered me, and he said, I've never been so scared in my entire life. He was okay, but he damn near fainted on the hood of my car, I'll tell you that.
Now, the moral of that story was that he actually shot your car.
He actually what?
He shot your car.
He told me the story that he tried to shoot out the window something and shot the front of your car.
No, I'm the one that shot the snake. And I shot out over the top of the windshield.
He told me a story, and I thought it was you, where he was shooting and said he stuck the gun out the side rather than getting up over the top. He stuck it out the window and he shot around, and he wound up shooting the headlight out on that side of the car.
Oh no! That was the big dummy. One time we saw one, and he got all panicky. And everything, and he had the gun laying on the floorboard, right? And it was in a holster. So he reaches down real quick to try to get the gun and everything. As he's pulling the gun out of the holster and everything, he shot a hole through my floorboard.
Hold on. I'd have stopped calling him.
Oh.
He was something. Well, you mentioned your brother Larry. Were you a fan growing up in St. Joseph, Jody, or did you get in the wrestling business because of Larry?
No, I was a fan. I knew from the time that I was a little kid that I was either going to be a boxer or a wrestler, and I tried my hand at both, you know. And when I was 14. I was fighting middleweight, and I won a bunch of tournaments around our hometown and everything. And then I ended up going. I won a tournament they had a big tournament in St. Joe. I won it, and they had another one in in Kansas City that I won at, and I ended up going to Chicago for the national championship and everything, and I got beat there. I got decisioned. I was 14 fighting middleweight, which is probably in the amateurs, but middleweight is probably the toughest division of all because the guys are older. You know, the guy that beat me was, like I say, I was 14. The guy that I got beat by was 28 years old from Lackland Air Force Base. I did okay, you know. And then there was a kind of an unscrupulous promoter there around St. Joe named Bucky Heilman. And he was a resident intern at the local clinic, and he was a very good welterweight fighter, and he was in line for a championship fight, and of course back in those days he was a good bit older than I was. And he, while in his boxing career, he was staying at an old hotel somewhere. And you remember those, the old radiators they used to have in the hotels?
Oh, yeah.
The little handle that you turn to turn them on and turn them off and everything. Well, he was in there, and he had one in his room and everything, but the handle had been taken off. And the knob was, that point was sticking up. And something happened where he got startled and tried to roll out of bed, got his foot hung up in the sheets, fell over backwards, and that knob there, that stem that the knob goes on and everything, went right at the base of his skull and everything, he ended up with nerve damage of all places. He got hit him in the back of the head like that, but the nerve damage ended up in his leg, where he couldn't move backwards with his left leg. He could move forward fine and never walked with a limp or anything. He just could not step backwards with his left leg. So that naturally ended his boxing career. But anyway, he started promoting some fights around there, and of course, hell, I was a punk-ass kid still in high school and everything. You know, I didn't know the difference. And technically, I guess, I was a professional boxer because on the shows that he promoted and so on, you got $25 if you won and you got $15 if you lost. They chalked it up to expense money and so on, which was got around the amateur professional type thing, you know.
Right.
So I didn't have to quit playing football and basketball and track and stuff in high school. But I had a bunch. I had, I think I ended up 19-3 doing those fights. And, you know, I got pretty much exposed to the underside of boxing. And then I don't know, I kind of lost interest in it. And then Don Farrow, who was head coach at Missouri University at the time, he came down to our high school to take a look at me and a kid named Alan Richardson. And he was really pumping up the college and invited me to come down and visit the campus and da-da-da-da-da, like all recruiters do and everything, you know. And he said, son, he said, I think you would do very well. He said, get yourself a great education and everything. And he said, I think you'd make a great running guard, pulling guard on our football team. Well, hell, I was a fullback in high school, a fullback and a linebacker, you know. And I said, running guard? I said, Coach, they don't score no touchdowns. He just kind of looked at me kind of funny and shook his head and everything. But, hell, I didn't have enough money to go to college, and there wasn't anybody in my family that had enough money to send me to college and stuff, you know. So shortly after that, I had my... I was working out at up there at the YMCA with Sonny Myers, and God, it was horrible up there. We had no ring or anything, and all we had was a bunch of those old rough canvas tumbling mats, that we'd shove five or six of them together, and you know, and every time you'd step from one to the other and everything, they'd come apart because they didn't have any fasteners or anything on them. And but he trained me some and everything, and got me ready. And then in the summer of '56, I actually had my first pro match, and it was at Graceland College, Lamona, Iowa. Never forget it.
Who was it with?
Who knew? Rip Hawk.
Really? Wow. I would imagine in the time frame.
That happened as an accident.
Oh, really?
Because I went up there with Johnny Weaver at the time. He was wrestling, trying to wrestle with Johnny Ace. And we pulled a ring up there for Gus. And after we got the ring all set up and everything, Johnny and I got in the ring and worked out a little bit. And he was showing me a few things and stuff, you know. So somebody didn't show up that night. I forget who it was. Whoever Rip Hawk was supposed to wrestle that night didn't show up. And they said, I never forget it. Old Bob Craddock. I don't know if you guys had ever heard of Bob Craddock or not, but Bob Craddock was an old carny that hung around St. Joe. And he was the guy that actually Gus Karras bought the Midwest promotions from. And Craddock was on the carnival. He ran some kind of a little gimmick game thing on the carnival, on Gus Karras' carnival. And he ran a few, after Gus bought him out and everything, he ran a few spot shows for Gus periodically. And this was one of them. And he talked real funny, and he talked carny all the time, carny language all the time. And he had a kind of a high-pitched voice, and he wasn't gay, but he was very effeminate type person, you know?
Right. And
so I was sitting in the dressing room talking to Johnny, and Craddock walks in, and he looks at me, and he says, "Hey, Slick," he says, "you got your gear?" And I said, "Yeah, I got it." He says, "Well, get it on, because we're getting your cherry tonight." And that was that's how I got my first match.
Well, that territory was, or that area was such a hotbed, I guess, while you were growing up as a fan with Orville Brown and Bobby Bruns and Lou Fez, of course, all those people in that territory.
Yeah.
You got to see all of them as a fan, and then I'm assuming you wrestled some of them along the way.
Well, Orville was out of the business by the time I started and everything,
right.
But I probably wrestled Fez 200 times.
Wow. See, Gary, how lucky you are. You only wrestled him once.
That's right. I was around Sonny Myers, but, you know, not when he was working. But I heard he was an unbelievable worker.
Sonny Myers, in my opinion, has never gotten the credit that he really deserves for his ability. But in my opinion, Sonny Myers was the best, and I say this unequivocally, he was the best all around performer I have ever seen.
I heard he was unbelievable.
He had the most phenomenal timing of anybody I've ever seen. And he was a great teacher. And the time that I spent in the Amarillo territory was the greatest learning experience that I've ever had. They had Sonny Myers was there. He was I wrestled him a lot, and he was a teacher. Iron Mike DiBiase, who was a great, great teacher, and Dory Funk Sr., although Funk never tried to teach me anything, but I learned a lot from just watching him, you know, because here was a guy that was probably over better than anybody that has ever been over in the entire history of the Amarillo Territory, and never threw a drop kick, never threw a flying head scissor. You know, he never did anything fancy or anything, but he was over, and the things that he did flawlessly, and he did them with and executed his moves with flawless timing. And he had great psychology in his matches. He was a great performer.
I had
the pleasure and the experience of working with him, and then believe it or not, I even learned a lot from watching Antone Ripper Leone. And he did nothing but bite and claw and scratch and gouge and kick and stomp and everything. But I learned a lot from him because he knew exactly when to do it and why, you know.
Right.
Because that's the whole psychology of the business, knowing what to do and when to do it.
But getting back to Sonny, he didn't venture out to a whole lot of different territories, did he, Jody?
Well, you know, Sonny at one time was in line to be the world's junior heavyweight champion, and because he was such a notorious ribber and so on, they decided not to do it. You know, I mean, he always carried his little machine that made the farting sounds, and he'd be sitting in a restaurant and he'd be at the counter in a restaurant and everything, and he'd slide that little farting machine under his leg and he'd let it go, and it sounded just like it was rubber bands wound up somehow or another. I don't know how the hell he did it, but he did it. And then he would jump up and look at the person next to him, especially if it was a woman. He'd jump up and look, because it was loud, you know. He'd jump up and look at the person next to him, and he said, "Well, excuse me." And the whole restaurant would think that person that was sitting next to him broke wind, you know. And it was stuff like that actually kept him from getting the title and everything. But he worked Tulsa. He worked Amarillo. He worked the Houston territory when it was Houston, when Morris Siegel had it, and that's where he got cut real bad.
Really?
Oh yeah, he was working heel down there, and he was working. I forget who it was now, but it was one of the top Mexican stars from down there. And one of those Mexicans didn't like it, didn't like the outcome of the match. So as Sonny was walking through the crowd back to the dressing room or anything, he walked around Sonny with one of them curved linoleum knives. Sonny's guts actually fell out in his hands.
Mm.
And they rushed him to the hospital and everything, and it took like 300 and some stitches to sew him back up.
He was actually, Jerry, he was a big star in the 50s because he was one of the big stars when they first started televising wrestling on the DuMont Network out of Chicago.
Chicago, absolutely.
He was there. And he toured off of that. He was kind of like a special. He came in here into Mobile in 54, 55, something like that, strictly off that Chicago television. Mm-hmm. He and Jesse James was another one.
Yeah.
He was a big, well-known off of television, so they would tour behind that.
Yeah.
And he actually spent some time, several months, working for Gulas. He was their top babyface for their top title at that time was the Southern Junior Heavyweight Championship for Welch and Gulas. And he would tour with that. He would work Mobile. He would go down into Florida with it. So he traveled a lot earlier in his career, but then he kind of settled into back into the Missouri area. And he had part of the office at one time, didn't he, Jody?
Not really. No, he had a lot of say so in the office, but he never wanted to be. He never really wanted to be a part of the office. One of the reasons why he kind of got himself off the road, so to speak, is because you know, his parents had a huge farm right out of St. Joe there. And when his parents got to where they couldn't take care of the farm and stuff, then Sonny did most of the farm work. And he'd work his ass off out running the tractor and plowing the fields and doing all that during the day and everything. Then he'd make his shots around St. Joe at night, you know. So he kept himself pretty busy.
Well, Jody, in those days, it was the office in St. Joe?
Oh, yeah, downtown.
All right. Who did Gus run Kansas City? Did he have the whole thing, or?
Gus had the whole thing, yeah.
He had the whole thing.
Yep. And then later on, he let Geigel and O'Connor buy in. And that was the beginning of the end of the territory. But that
now,
came,
you mentioned,
that,
go ahead,
that
Joe,
came
I'm
a good
sorry.
Bit later. Geigel and O'Connor, their era was a good bit later. Gus was pretty sick and wasn't feeling well, and he didn't have that same energy and same drive that he had at one time. So he needed help and everything. And Gus was a funny guy. Gus was like some other people that I have met down through the years and everything. The people that were loyal to him, like my brother and Sonny and Ronnie Etchison and so on and so forth, he kind of shunned them and then gave Geigel and O'Connor the opportunity to buy into the territory instead of my brother and Ronnie and Sonny. And I was never one of Gus's real favorites anyway, because I more or less told them all to kiss my ass when they wanted me to go out and second. I went out one season on the at show and on the carnival and everything, taking on all comers and everything, you know, for $15 a week. That's a tough life, brother. And I had to help take some of the rides down and this and that and so on, sleeping in the bed of a truck and all that, you know. And then he wanted me to come back for the second season, and I said, no, not me, buddy. So fortunately, that was when that was in the summer of 57. And like I said, I'd already had a couple of pro matches and everything. Like I said, my first one in the spring of 56. But in 57 is when I actually, Larry was in New York, and he actually got me started full-time up there in New York. I started September the 3rd, 1957, and never looked back.
And that was what I was going to bring up now, is if most people know, and for those that don't know, Jody's older brother was Larry Hamilton, some as Rocky Hamilton, best known as the Missouri Mauler.
Yeah.
You guys worked in New York, and you actually had the distinction of being the youngest person to ever headline Madison Square Garden.
Yeah. Yeah. That happened May 24th, 1958. And that record still stands. I'm still the youngest guy. I was 19 years old and wrestled the main event, Madison Square Garden. My brother and I against Argentina Roca and Perez, Miguel Perez.
Well, that's something to be proud of.
Yeah, well, you know, when I'm asked about highlights of my career and so on, that's certainly in the top three. If not
you
the
worked,
top.
Didn't you work that match with a bad ankle injury?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I almost broke my ankle the night before. And it was all swollen up and everything. But, you know, when you're young like that, you suck it up. And I wouldn't let anybody, Larry knew, of course, but I wouldn't let anybody else know that my ankle was hurt. And then right before the match, you know, we got our checked out with all the commission doctors and all that. Now, if the commission doctor didn't know my ankle was in that bad of shape and everything, he wouldn't have let me go. And there was no way, hell or high water, I was going to be in the ring that night, you know, because I dreamed about that my entire life, as short as it was at the time. But anyway, Larry had bought a couple of rolls of tape. And he knew how to tape ankles and everything. And I'm telling you, he put a taping on my ankle that was like a cast and everything. And then between that and the adrenaline that was flowing, the ankle, I forgot about the ankle until it was all over with, you know.
And another distinction Jody has, a lot of people don't realize Jody was the original Rocky Monroe. Jody came into Mobile in, I've got it written down here somewhere, November of 59, and worked as Ricky the Rocket Monroe, as being the brother of Rocky Sputnik Monroe.
Yeah.
And worked a draw and ended up with a draw with Luigi Massera, who just passed away about a month ago.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I'll be darned. Yeah, they're dropping like flies now.
So you weren't here very long. Did you let them put a streak in your hair and everything?
Yeah. Yeah, but it didn't last long.
I guess that was your first meeting with Buddy Fuller, wasn't it? Because he was the promoter down here at that time.
No, Fuller was in Memphis at the time.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
Was there, I guess, Rocky McGuire? Well,
Fuller was getting ready. Fuller was getting ready to come down and take it over and everything. And that's when I went in there. But because I was actually working Memphis with for Fuller.
Okay.
And I went from Memphis down to Mobile.
You did come back in July of 61. Under your name, Joe Hamilton, and you were in the one round of the tournament to name a new Gulf Coast champion, and you wrestled Mario Galanto and put him over. That had to be fun.
Mm-hmm.
You stayed a couple weeks that time before you moved on. You again weren't
no,
here for
I
very
was,
long.
We came up from Florida. Worked,
oh, really?
Worked a few, yeah, I was working Florida at the time. We came up, as a matter of fact, we flew up in Eddie Graham's plane and worked a few shots and went on back.
You know, that's right, because Eddie was in that same tournament. Jerry was already in here. In fact, Jerry wound up winning the tournament, Jerry Graham.
Mm-hmm.
And Eddie Graham came up, and I think Joe Scarpello, was he down there with you guys too? I think he came here about the same time.
You're right. Yeah, I had forgotten about that, but he was there.
Okay, because you guys were all here at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And then from Florida, I guess you went into Georgia, fans wearing the mask. Yeah, but you weren't the assassin. What were they going to call you, the Iron Russian or something like that?
Yeah, I originally came in here as the Iron Russian, so when they made the deal for me to come in here from Florida and everything, I was supposed to be the Iron Russian and everything. So, hell, I had all the little stretchy nylon pullover type mask made, and I had the Russian sickle and the red Russian star on the forehead and all that and everything, you know. It was kind of hilarious because the very first night, I didn't know where to go or anything, you know, but I found a parking spot by the auditorium's back door, and I was always there early, and walked in. There was nobody there at the back door, so I walked right to the front door, and the guy at the front door saw me coming in with a mask and wearing a mask and carrying my suitcase. And so on. And knowing that I was going to be the Iron Russian and everything, I mustered up my best Russian accent, and I said, "That is dressing room." And the guy looked at me. He said, "Well, I don't know exactly where it is." So I just took a chance, and I saw. I walked right through the middle of the old downtown city auditorium, where I walked right through the middle of it, and back up on the stage. And lo and behold, there were the dressing rooms back there. But and then when they told me that I was not the Iron Russian, I was going to be the assassin and everything, I really felt like a bigger idiot. Thinking back about it, how better is the dressing room? I asked that guy at the front.
How long were you the assassin by yourself before Tom came in?
Well, let's see. I think I came in here, started in here in October, around the 1st of October. Then, it was probably the middle of November when Tom came in.
And that was, what, 61, 62?
61, yep.
61, okay. So, because I don't know if you ever knew this or not, but in 1962, by that time, Fuller had sold out to Lee Fields, and Lee Fields owned the Mobile territory.
Right.
They were using Corsica Joe and Red Donovan as the assassins here.
Right.
And then right in the middle of that run, they suddenly changed their name to the Untouchables. And I'm assuming either you guys or Gunkel had something to do with that name change.
You know, it's been so damn long ago, I'm not really sure how that came about, but I think, I'm pretty sure that that Eddie Graham had something to do with it, too.
Okay.
And, of course, Gunkel and Eddie never got along, and Gunkel and the Fields never got along and all that, so I doubt that they would have done anything for Gunkel. We made our feelings known about it, and then I think because we were good drawing cards in Florida also, and there was like a conflict of one team of the assassins working towns in North Florida, and then another
right.
team of the assassins and so on, so Eddie told them out of professional courtesy they needed to change their names, you know. And they did.
Yeah.
But then later on, Roger Smith and Randy Colley, they worked the Nashville and Memphis territory using the same name, so, you know.
They worked at Mobile for Fuller.
Yeah, they worked Mobile, too, yeah.
Yeah, so. So, Alto, how long were you and Tom together as the assassins?
15 years.
Wow. That's a long partnership.
Honestly say that Tom was a great partner. He was a great man, a great teacher, and in all the 15 years we were together, we never had a crossword.
Well, I'll tell you what. I've been asked who I thought the greatest team was of all time. I thought y'all were. I mean,
well,
really.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
That's no kidding, Jody. I mean, y'all had so much class, and you know, and the interviews were unbelievable. You know, didn't get out there and scream and holler, and y'all just, I mean, it was just.
Well, you know,
what it was supposed to be.
When, excuse me, when Tom and I got together. Tom did the brunt of the talking and everything because I wasn't very good. And Tom told me, he said, "Listen, I don't want to do all the interviews." He said, "And interviewing is becoming a very important part of our wrestling careers now." He says, "So, and I used to practice doing interviews. He and I riding up and down our highway together." Going to different towns and stuff. Hell, I'd do promos. I'd do interviews and stuff, you know. And what it was, Tom had great psychology, and Tom's philosophy was, if you got a team and one guy does all the talking, then he is the focal point of the team, and the other guy is the weak sister. And yep. he never wanted the people to differentiate between he and I. He wanted the people to know, even though we look so much alike, and the average person really couldn't tell us apart. You know, with the long outfits and the new mask and stuff that we had made, they couldn't tell us apart hardly. So anyway, I went ahead and worked my hind end off to try to become adequate on the microphone, and the whole thing boils down to Tom said, I will not always start an interview. I want you to start one interview, and the next time we do an interview, I'll start it, and you finish it. But we never had an interview where one of us did the whole interview and the other one didn't say anything. We always had where if I would start, Tom, I'd have a lead-in line for Tom to finish it, and Tom would give me, if he started it, he would have a lead-in line for me to finish the interview. So consequently, there was never any, and as a team was, we lived. Now this is God's truth. We lived our team. Okay. When I say we lived our team, there was no Assassin One or Assassin Two. Even though, yeah, I was the original Assassin, but to Tom, there was no Assassin One or no Assassin Two. There was only the team of the Assassins, and that's how we try to conduct our business.
Let me just say, you succeeded highly on becoming a proficient promo man. Trust me, you became one of the best in the business, best I've ever heard. Anyway, very, very much, and it's just what Jerry was saying. Especially for a heel, it's more terrifying for a heel who is very calm and collected when they do their promos, as opposed to one that's out there ranting and raving. And
well, you know, Tom and I teamed up in an era where Dick the Bruiser was becoming very, very popular.
Right.
And all the heels in the business were trying to emulate Dick the Bruiser and everything because they figured that if they went and talked like him and wrestled like him and everything, that they would get over like him. Well, there was only one Dick the Bruiser, you know, and anything else was nothing but an imitation. So consequently, we never tried to be like Dick the Bruiser. First of all, that wasn't my nature, and it wasn't Tom's nature or his personality. And whenever you wrestle as a character or as a personality, you're doing yourself and the character an injustice if you try to stray too far away from your own true personality. And Tom and I, our true personalities were very similar. In other words, what you saw in that ring was just an extension of our own true personalities and so on. You know, it's like, yeah, I'll cut corners in real life. If I was in a fight, I'm going to cut corners. I'm going to do whatever I can to win, you know. And
right.
if I'm going to meet Jerry Oates face to face, and I figure there's a better than even chance that Jerry Oates is going to kick my hind in, then what am I going to do? I'm going to stall for time until I can catch Jerry Oates off guard, and then I'm going to waylay his ass. And that's my true personality. And that was the type of personality that we portrayed as the team of the Assassins.
And that's why I've had double knee replacement.
I'm just sitting here listening.
Well,
Jerry's talking about how great they were. You shouldn't have been kicking me in the head
with the knees.
Is that what it was?
Jerry's talking about how great they were. They wasn't pinching your arms and aggravating you, and you
just didn't see it.
Jody, tell the story. I'm sitting here thinking of things. Tell the story about the guy that sat on the front row in Atlanta that worked at the gas station. Remember the guy y'all went in the gas station and?
Well, you know, back in those days, all the gas stations were full service. And almost every gas station had one of those, it was like a trough full of water that you'd, you know, if you had a leak in your inner tube, when all the tires had inner tubes back then, if you had a leak in your inner tube and everything, you take the inner tube out of your tire and everything, blow it up, stick it in the water, and wherever it started bubbling and everything, you'd know that's where the puncture was. So you put a patch on it. Well, this guy used to sit at front row, and we didn't know it. It was strictly by accident. We pulled into the gas station, and there he was, the attendant. So he was an obnoxious person, and I'm being kind when I describe him that way. Okay?
Yes, he is.
So anyway, I didn't say anything. I just kind of stood aside because if he'd have talked to me like he was talking to Tom, I'd have probably slapped him in the mouth. But Tom was too cool for that, you know. And back in those days, one of the big ribs was filling one of the lighter fluid cans up with half lighter fluid and half oil and mustard. Now, I don't know if you know what oil and mustard is, but if you've ever been shot with pure oil and mustard and everything, wherever you got hit, it blistered. It would just flat burn you, okay? So we diluted it so it wouldn't blister, but it would still burn the hell out of you. So we carried it around in one of them cans of Ronson lighter fluid cans. So this guy is being real obnoxious to Tom and everything, and Tom is just being ever so polite. Just like, oh, well, you can say anything you want to me, and I'm going to take it and like it, and just, oh, I'm just going to be Mr. Nice. But he had no idea who the hell we were, you know. Anyway, so Tom had a brand new Chrysler, New Yorker at the time. And the damn dipstick on that thing, now this guy wasn't very tall. And the dipstick was way down at the bottom of the engine block. So Tom says, I hate to ask you this. He said, but would you please do me a favor and check my oil for me, please? And the guy looked at him, well, I guess so. All right, and everything. So the guy had to kind of hike his leg up on the fender to bend over to get himself down in there far enough to reach the dipstick, right? And boy, his hindquarters was perfectly exposed. And Tom's, he laid it on him. I mean, he squirted this guy with that oil and mustard up one cheek and down the other, brother. And, of course, you can't feel that stuff when it's going on, you know, especially through a pair of jeans. So after he got through and everything, we acted like we were driving off and everything, and we drove just far enough down the driveway where we could see what was going on. Well, it wasn't but about 4 or 5 minutes later, and there was cars in the drive. You know, he was servicing other cars, and all of a sudden he stops and he starts twitching, and he's grabbing at the cheeks of both cheeks of the butt, and trying to. He's looking around behind him, and he's looking behind him, and he looked like a dog chasing his tail. He's going in a circle, trying to find out what was causing this burning sensation on his butt. And he reached back, and he's trying to pull his pants away from his butt and everything, but it was too late. That stuff had already soaked through. So. Right there, this is a guy's truth, right there in front of women, men, and children. This guy dropped his laundry, and when I say laundry, I'm talking about the whole Magilla, brother, right down past the jockey shorts, and stuck his bare ass in that inner tube trough, not knowing what was happening to him, and certainly not knowing that sticking in his butt in that water and everything, water intensifies the burn. I mean, it doesn't last forever. It only lasts for about 5 minutes and everything. But I'm telling you, Tom and I laughed so hard, we almost wrecked the car getting out of the parking lot.
Yeah.
We never went back.
I think you can still buy that stuff. I've got a few people I'd like to try that on.
You'll see him that Friday night at ringside.
Now, Bobby has told stories of traveling with you guys on here a few times, and again, I'd like to get it from the horse's mouth, that you guys had a habit of, what would you call it, midnight grocery shopping in cornfields?
Oh, God, yeah.
He told me and Nick, Joe Jr.'s in the front seat. He was about 13, and I'm driving. Him and Tom's in the back seat of Jody's big 98, and he tells me to stop and kick the tires. Well, I thought he's ribbing. And he goes, yeah, kick the tires, kick the tires. And I said, well, kick the tires or I'm going to kick you. Okay, so I get out, and I'm kicking tires, and they just disappeared into the dark. I didn't know where they were, and I could hear them. Open the trunk, open the trunk. Here they all three come out, but they had double arm loads of corn. But I could see the headline in the little paper there, wherever we were, you know, three guys shot and fourth laying in the middle of the road. This is skipping way ahead, Mike, and Jody might not remember this, but just, I got a funny line from him. Him and Rock Hunter were promoting some towns in South Carolina. We were working for Ann, and they were booked somewhere. And I had to take the ring over to the town that they had booked in South Carolina. And this is a God's honest truth. I don't remember the town or whatever, but
Orangeburg.
No, it wasn't Orangeburg. This was a spot show somewhere at a high school. And I rode okay. through the little town and didn't see the school. I didn't even see a town. And I turned around and came back, still didn't see it. And I finally stopped at the gas station, and the guy said, the school's on the backside of this cornfield. He said, turn in this dirt road, go down through the cornfield. And sure enough, there was a school there. Long story short, when I went to check up that night, the guy told me, he said, we don't pay sales tax. And I said, what do you mean you don't pay sales tax? And he goes, I said, everybody pays sales tax. He goes, we don't. And we argued a little bit until finally he pulled his coat back and exposed the butt of a pistol in a shoulder holster. And I said, well, okay, you don't pay sales tax. So I checked up, went back. Well, the next day I got with Jody and Rock, gave him everything, told him about the sales tax thing. And they did a pretty good little house, so they were going to run it again. And he said, well, he just didn't understand, or we'll get it worked out. The next time they run it, I wasn't there. And one of the best lines I ever heard Jody say, I asked him the day after the second show, I said, did the guy pay the sales tax? And Jody looked at me and went, that guy don't pay sales tax. Okay, just making sure.
Yeah.
Jody, when you and Tom started in Georgia, was Leo the Booker?
Did what?
Was Leo the Booker? When you and Tom started in Georgia.
Yeah.
What did you think of him as a booker, your opinion?
Well, Leo had some great ideas.
Yes, he did.
But Leo trying to be the greatest booker of all times couldn't leave a good idea alone. He had to keep adding stuff to it and adding stuff to it and adding stuff to it till he diluted the product so badly with a bunch of garbage and everything that it lost its original concept. And that was his downfall. Fortunately, he would listen to Tom and I, and we could curtail him when it come to stuff that involved us. But ideas, thoughts, angles for other people and everything, he was off the wall with it. But the guy had some great original ideas. If he'd have just left him alone instead of trying to add all that junk to it and everything, he'd have been fine.
Yeah. I was just wanting your opinion of him. What do you think of Louis Tellez as a booker?
Terrible. Never liked Louis as a booker.
Liked him as a person, okay.
Liked him, liked his work in the ring, okay, and everything. But as far as a booker and so on, Louis, uh, Louis,
Louis fell prey to the same thing that a lot of bookers have fallen prey to and everything, and that's the buddy system. In other words, if you're their buddy and everything, then he's going to push you whether you could draw a dime or not.
There you go.
Man, that's been the downfall of a lot of good, a lot of bookers that that probably could have, there maybe could have made it, you know. But they had this thing in their mind where they thought that they had to surround themselves with guys that were going to be loyal to them, whether they could draw any money or not. And consequently, most of the guys that they were friendly with or that would be loyal to them and everything generally couldn't draw you a dime. So, you know, you had 10 for a point when you use that type of system. And if you're a crap shooter, you know what 10 for a point means. That's the hardest one to make.
Go ahead, Jerry. I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. Go ahead.
I was going to say, in a similar vein, you work quite a bit with Dusty. And Dusty, I know a lot of people blame him for pushing himself when he was at the book. And I guess in a booker's mind, who do you trust? You know, you trust yourself, so you put yourself on top. So what was your thoughts of Dusty as a booker?
I'm sorry, what was that?
What was your thoughts of Dusty as a booker, Dusty Rhodes? Because you worked with him quite a bit.
Well, the difference between Dusty and a lot of those bookers and everything that booked themselves on top and everything, Dusty drew money. Most of those other bookers didn't draw you a dime, you know. But they still put themselves on top because they had the power to do it. I don't find fault with a booker putting himself on top if he can draw money, because your first obligation is to the man that signs your check, and that's the guy that owns the company.
Right.
So if you can't, you know, if you can't draw money, then you're not doing him any good. If the system that you're using by pushing yourself on top or pushing your buddies on top is not drawing as much money as you could if you used other people and other personalities and so on, then you're not doing your job, and you're not being loyal to the man that's signing your checks.
Right.
Who is one of the best bookers that you work for other than Tom?
Leo Voss.
Is that right?
Yep. He was also one of the best referees I've ever seen.
Now, he was one of McGurk's bookers, right?
Well, he started out in Charlotte.
Oh, did he?
And then left Charlotte and went to Tulsa. But he and Tom were good buddies, and so on. But he was there during Tom's debut as the Great Bolo in Charlotte, and Leo, along with Tom's ideas, Leo was instrumental in the tremendous run of success that Tom had there as a single, and then later on, of course, Leo was gone by the time Tom and I went back. But the success that Tom had was duplicated by the success that he and I had back there as the Great Bolo and Bolo.
Now, you just missed Tom, because Tom was in here in 1960 as the Great Bowl. By here, I mean Mobile, because that's where I am right now. That's why I say here. Tom came in here. Well, he had been in here in 57 or 58 as Tony Martin.
Right.
And he came back in early 1960s, the Great Bowl. I think he was on his way from Texas to Charlotte, and he stopped in here and was here, I think, 2-3 months maybe. And then went on to Charlotte with the,
mm-hmm.
the bowl of death.
Yeah, he was actually on his way from L.A.
Oh, was he?
Okay. Yeah. He and Al Lovelock got booked in Charlotte as the Great Bolo and Bolo.
Right.
So they took off separately, of course, across country. And like most people did in those days, they worked their way across country. So when they ended up in Amarillo, they offered Lovelock the job as booker. So he told Tom to go on to Charlotte and everything alone. Because he was staying there and was going to take the job as booker. So Tom went on and finished his bookings out across the country and ended up in Charlotte as the Great Bolo. And then when he hit and everything got red hot and everything, then Lovelock come in and tried to sue him. Oh, no, Lovelock was a wonderful person. You know, he kind of reminded me of that that snake that almost bit George. Maybe not quite as trustworthy as the snake.
How many territories? Go ahead, Jerry. I'm sorry.
I want to ask you, what did you think of Jim Barnett?
Oh, my God. Jimsy. Jim was a tyrannical little turd when he was in power and owned territories and had something to say about the business and everything. And I had many head-to-head confrontations with him. And I mean that literally, because he and I, we disagreed adamantly on philosophies about the business and different ideas and thoughts and angles and so on. And even though I made a lot of money working for him and so on, I did not get along well with him. However, Jim and I did become pretty damn good friends once he no longer had a territory and once we were both working for WCW in different capacities. And that's when we became close friends.
I never understood why he went to work if he was what he said he was all these years, why he went to work for McMahon.
Because he needed the money.
Thank you. End of story.
Jim spent all his money.
Well, from the story, I know Bobby worked for him, and he took care of Bobby, and that's, you can only go by how somebody treats you.
Right.
Yeah. I know how he treated me, what he did to me. And anyhow, that's another story.
Well, he did that to a lot of guys, so...
I know
you don't. Don't feel bad.
And I didn't have the balls back then to confront him. I should have confronted him. But anyhow,
yeah.
You know, there's just out and out lie to somebody. You know.
Yeah.
Now he would do that. Y'all were here. Tom was the booker. He lied. He told Tom something. Tom told me. And I mean, this was not just Tom's word. When I did the knee deal with Pac Song, had to have surgery, I was going to be taken care of. You know what Jim Barnett paid me for 9 weeks? Not one penny.
Yeah.
He was supposed to pay me $300 a week. He didn't pay me a dime.
Yeah.
Fred Ward helped me out some, and two took up the collection for the rest of it. But anyhow, I heard several stories that he didn't have the money anyhow. His buddies had it.
Well, I don't think his buddy had all that much money either. Barnett made and spent several fortunes, you know. And Barnett was, he lost a lot of money, which he never wanted anybody to know this, but he lost a tremendous amount of money in the stock market. And, you know, wildcat investment type things and stuff, and he lost a lot of money doing that. But, If you look at it logically, I mean, knowing the business like I know it and like you know it and so on, I know Barnett's background. He came from a meager background. He was from Kansas City, of all places.
That is right. And he went to work for what office, Jody, doing the programs or writing the...
Right, and then he eventually started promoting a few towns here and there and so on. But as I said, knowing the business as we all know it and so on, where all of a sudden did he make all these millions and millions of dollars he was supposed to have? Never happened.
It never happened. I told Ralph Reed and Ole Anderson
I said, he has to be the greatest worker that ever entered the business. Everybody was horrified of him because he was supposed to be this jillionaire.
Yeah.
They trembled.
Yeah. I never bought that crap anyway.
You have to think, when he was had promotions until he got into Atlanta, he never had a promotion of just him. It was always him and Johnny Doyle.
Yeah.
They had Indianapolis together. They were in Australia together. And, you know, that was so, I don't know, maybe he siphoned out of that. Who knows? But, now.
Yeah, well, when I first met Johnny Doyle, it was in 1957. He was a partner with the New York office, in the New York office. He had, I don't know what his percentage was, but I know that he was a major partner. And that's when Vince McMahon Sr. Was just running, he just had a couple of towns that he was promoting, and was running the old Uline Arena there in Washington, D.C.
When you went up there the first time, Jody, when Larry was there, who owned that territory?
Johnny Doyle and Rudy Dusick. And they bumped finally bumped Rudy Dusick out. There was Johnny Doyle and a couple other guys that were the owners. Cola Corleone was their booker.
And prior to that, Johnny Doyle had Los Angeles. He owned Los Angeles in the late 40s, early 50s, and sold out to Cal Eaton.
Mm-hmm.
Which was Cal Eaton.
Well, Doyle bounced around a lot of places.
Yeah.
He ended up in Canada. Fighting extradition.
I didn't realize he did anything after he and Barnett sold out of Australia. Now, did you and Tom ever work in Australia for Barnett?
Oh, yes. Several times.
How many different places did you guys work? I know you worked Georgia, Florida.
You name it, we've been there.
Yeah. Eastern Canada, the Carolinas, Arizona. Were you guys together in Los Angeles?
Oh, yeah.
In almost every one of those territories, you guys had the Kentuckians with you. Just
pretty close.
Well, I know this is a hard question. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Mike.
I was going to say, I know this is a hard question considering how many matches and how many people that you guys work with, but who would you think was the best team that you guys clicked with the best and did the best business with? You and Tom.
Who did we do the most business with?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
All right, the answer to the first part, who do we do the most business with, would be, hands down, the Kentuckians. I mean, we saw every territory that we were ever in with these guys and everything, we did capacity business, up to and including the biggest house I ever had in Vancouver. And as far as the team that we had... that I thought was maybe one of the best teams around as far as baby faces and stuff are concerned, were two guys that never got much recognition and everything. It was the Scott brothers. We had some fantastic matches with those guys.
Individually, who was your favorite person to work against?
As a single?
Right, yeah.
Dick Steinborn.
As I figured that was going to be your answer. And I don't know if you've been told or not, but he's not as bad off as you had heard. I don't know if Scott Till's actually talked to him, and his wife passed away, but other than that, he's doing okay himself.
Good. Glad to hear.
Hopefully we'll get him, get back in touch with him and have him on the show with us and everything. So what was it? What did you guys work, a 2 hours and 44 minute match in Augusta?
2 hours and 46 minutes.
Oof.
I ate 12 bags of popcorn watching that match.
In the balcony in Augusta.
Oh, it was something. It was something. They built up to that, man. It was unbelievable. It was unbelievable.
Yeah. The first week we went an hour, no falls. Second week we went 90 minutes, no falls. And then that week they started the matches at exactly 9:15. The bell to begin our match rang at exactly 9:15. And at 12:01 midnight, which was 2 hours and 46 minutes later, Steve Manderson rang the bell again to stop the matches, said it was Tuesday morning. He no longer had a lease on a building. Still hadn't had a fall.
Nobody left either, Joey.
No, they all stayed, and when it was over with, we got a standing ovation for the two. Because a lot of the people knew that they were seeing history, because that's still the longest match in the history of the old Bell Auditorium.
Jerry, you were working for the opposition at that time. How did that match leave?
Uh-uh.
You weren't working for the Georgia office at that time?
Yeah, I was working for the Georgia office.
Yeah.
That was before the split.
Oh, that was okay. That was before the split. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. I've got my dates mixed up on that. But I'm going to say, if I had been working for the Georgia office and that would happen under Gunkel's banner, I would have been wondering what the other office needed to do to top that.
Joe, do you remember the night you and Tom worked in Columbus? He was to take his mask off.
Mm-hmm.
That was on a Monday night, right? I'm booked in Columbus with Mr. Ward's. You know, I was working for the other office.
Yeah.
I went down there. I'm sitting in the balcony watching it. I went down there just to see how y'all were going to pull that off. Everybody's. I said, y'all go on now. I come down here to watch wrestling. Y'all leave me alone. That's how impressed I was with the Assassins.
I'll tell you something, Jerry, about pulling a mask off. I was 15, maybe 16. I was putting the TV ring up, running errands for Harbin. I'm standing behind the camera, probably 5 feet behind the camera, as Capel and Ernesto were doing that interview on Atlanta TV when he reached up and yanked that hood off. Son, you talk about. Listen, Capel didn't know what was going on, and neither did anybody else. That's the darndest thing I'd ever seen.
It was unbelievable.
I wish I had.
Yeah, I was in Japan when that happened.
You were in Japan, wasn't you, Jody?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, he sent me a telegram.
Hmm.
I didn't know he was going to do it till I got the telegram. Then he said, I'll explain everything to you later.
Hmm. Yeah, I can't remember exactly how he worded it. He said something about somebody to somebody's family and something that did this and did that. He reached up and yanked that thing off and looked at the camera and said, "My name's Thomas Anthony Ernesto, and now you don't have to worry about the mask." And he walked off. I mean, he come right by me going in the dressing room. I was like,
"Yeah, well, that's during the opposition days when Watson, Bill Watson, him, and they were all threatening to expose Tom and me and tell everybody who we were and all that and everything." Well, you know, I mean, really, I told Tom later. I said, "Well, what the hell difference would it have made?" I said, "How many wrestling fans know Tom Ernesto or who Tom Ernesto is?" I said, "How many wrestling fans anymore?" I said, "There may be a few scattered handfuls around Missouri that remember me, and a few people in New York maybe remember the name, and so on." I said, "But hell," I said, "nobody down here would remember." I said, "So what the hell difference would it made?" You know. But he had, you know, Tom had his own way of doing things and everything, and like I say, I was off in Japan, so anyway, it happened, and you know, what the hell, Tom, I'm sure Tom thought that that was the right thing to do at the time.
Oh yeah.
You know, had I been here, I would have opposed it. But
he was very, yeah. He was very methodical. I mean, he everything he did, he thought out. Or you know, I mean, I the year Tom died, he came to the reunion in Mobile, and I got to the Saturday night after the reunion was over. There was a bunch of us went over to Biloxi to eat, and a bunch of them went in the casino. And Tom had the stroke, and he wasn't nearly as agile as he used to be. And he sat down on a stool, kind of overlooking the casino, and I sat down next to him, and for the one time in my life of knowing him and all the years that I'd been around him, for 2.5 hours, me and him sit there and talked. And we didn't talk as my boss talking to me or as an older person talking to a kid, but we talked as friends and as peers. And that is 2.5 hours of my life that I am so thankful for, because I learned so much from the guy, and he was so good to me all those years, and I'm glad I got to spend that time with him.
Yeah, well, you know, there aren't many days go by that I don't miss this out again.
Yeah.
We did, you know, we had a hell there for 15 years. I spent more time with him than I did my own family.
Yeah.
We were riding up and down the roads and all that, you know, and I'll always be eternally grateful to him for all the things that he taught me about this business and everything, and I think I made a quote about it, made comments about it, I should say, in the book that I wrote. But, you know, he and I could read each other's thoughts and moods and everything. And when I'd go pick him up, or he'd go come and pick me up where we were living and everything, to make a trip to the town and everything, I could just look at him and tell what kind of a mood he was in, you know. And we all have our own moods and everything, and sometimes I'm in a mood where I don't really feel like talking a hell of a lot. And Tom used to get in those same moods. So I could look at him, and I could tell that he's not in a talking mood, so I just didn't talk to him until he initiated the conversation, you know. And the same with me. He could look at me and tell I wasn't really in a talkative mood, so he wouldn't even say anything until I initiated the conversation. And this one particular time, we were in the car and we're going to Augusta. And I didn't say anything to him, and he didn't say anything to me. I mean, we nodded and said, "Hey, Tom, how you doing? Da 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 da." We sit down and we take off, right? So it must have been 45 minutes to an hour. We sit there and really hadn't said anything to any, you know, to either party hadn't said anything. And finally Tom turned to me and he said, "Partner," he said, "and this to me was the greatest compliment that I've ever had in my life." He turned to me and he said, "I can't teach you anymore about your ring work." He says, "You're already better than I am." He says, "And you take far better bumps and a lot more of them." He says, "So from now on," he says, "what I'm going to teach you is the business end of wrestling." And when he told me those words and everything, I felt like I felt more proud than I did being 19 years old in the main event at Madison Square Garden, because I had worked so hard to hold up my end of the team. And when he told me that, I got choked up. I couldn't talk for a few more miles at least. then we just, you know, we just start talking, and then from then on, basically what it was, because he never coached me anymore about doing the interviews and so on, because he said that I was doing the right thing and saying the right things on interviews and handling them the right way, and the ring work and so on, you know. And then started the education on the business end of wrestling business, and that was invaluable also to me.
Well, coming from him, that was a heck of a compliment, sir.
Yes, it was, and that's exactly how I took it. And I can sit here right now, and I don't even have to close my eyes. I can visualize sitting in that car riding down the highway and him saying those words to me. It's just like it's happening right now, you know.
He was fun to work for, I know that. I enjoyed working for him. I really did.
Well, you know, Tom was one of the things that made Tom a good booker, and of course, in some ways it was his downfall, was the fact that, as I said before, what makes a good booker is, and I learned this from Tom too, I would use my own worst enemy if I thought he could draw me money.
Thank you, sir.
You know?
Thank you.
Because, first of all, if I use my own worst enemy, and generally when people dislike each other, it's not a terribly well-kept secret among the wrestling fraternity. So they say, hey, goddamn, you know, Joe Hamilton, he used so-and-so, and he used him on top and everything, and they hate each other's guts. So that opens the door and the opportunities for a lot more people to come in. And after all, as I explained before, isn't that the booker's first priority? Isn't that his job, to put matches together and people in those positions and everything that's going to draw the maximum amount of money? Because that's, you owe that to the guy that's signing your checks.
Absolutely.
Well, guys, we're getting down here we've only got a few minutes left, but there's a couple of people that have been hanging on the line, old friends of yours, Jody, that I know want to speak to you. So let me get them on with this first person. Let me get him on with us real quick. Joe Turner, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Real quick, Joe, tell us a Jody Hamilton story.
Jody Hamilton.
Well, Joe Turner.
I think Jody might remember the time we were talking about, y'all was talking about the snake a while ago. It's the time we was going down to America's, that snake deal there.
About the hogs?
Do what?
Well, I can't hardly hear you.
Do you remember the time that we was going to America's, Georgia?
Well, what happened?
There's a snake in the road, and we ran over the snake. Somebody did. And you, when we got there, you was working with the Avengers.
I remember that now. Yeah. You put the snake in the trunk of the car or something, didn't you?
No, but remember we threw that rope over that dressing room.
Yeah.
And when you was working the Avenger, you had him in a headlock, and you reached down in your trunk like you had that snake.
I had the referee tell him that I had a snake in my tights, and I was going to get that snake and put that snake on him. He was definitely afraid of him, you know. I snatched that headlock on him. I reached that hand down inside them trunks and everything, and you couldn't have held him if you'd have had 1,000 pounds of chain on him. He was gone. And he looked at from the he dove out of the ring, and he's standing there with one finger, with his index finger in the air, shaking it back and forth at the referee. He says, "Naughty snake, naughty snake."
Remember somebody took a rope and laid across the door handle out there in the middle of the
Yeah,
street.
I wonder who that was. some diabolical practical joker, no doubt.
Yeah. He threw them keys.
Joe, while I got you on the line here, how have you heard anything about Bill Bowman?
Yeah, I talk to him all the time.
Oh, yeah, do you?
Bill was on the line earlier. I was going to put him on with you, Jody, but he must have gotten another phone call or something. He dropped off.
Okay,
I talk to Bill every day, so Bill has become my adopted daddy.
Yeah, well, tell him I said hello. I haven't talked to Bill in a long time. We used to email back and forth all the time and everything, and then I got an email from his kids saying not to email him anymore for some reason.
Yeah, he doesn't have a computer anymore, but I'll let him know, and I'll pass along your phone number, too, if you'd like me to.
Yeah, please do. Yeah,
I will do so. Let me get the other person on here, and this person is celebrating a birthday tomorrow. So
while you're getting him on the phone, I know I wasn't there. This was a little before my time, but I understand a certain masked man won the America's Championship, and it was about a 6-inch trophy. And I was told by this guy you're pushing to Bill get on the phone that certain masked man stomped that thing into about 100 pieces and almost made Leon Ogle cry.
Yeah, it did make him cry. Look what you did to my trophy. What a wimpy puss.
Jody, I wish you'd come down to a reunion where we all sit around and talk about old times one time.
Well, I might do that.
Yeah.
When is it?
It's March the 1st or 2nd. Or something like that. Exactly 4 weeks from tomorrow. Charlie, you there?
Yeah.
Happy birthday, Charlie.
Yeah, thank you. Like Joe Hamilton, he's the worst wrestler I ever met in my life, you know.
You know, he was damn near as bad a wrestler as that Charlie Smith was a referee. Wasn't worth sour owl dung.
Hey, you know that 2.5-hour match we went into Augusta, you know, I refereed it. You know what they followed up with next week? Jody, you remember?
Well, yeah.
What was it? You said you remember.
Yeah. First guy to break the rules loses.
What happened for the finish?
I don't remember.
Mr. X is sitting on the front row dressed up like a woman. He jumped in the ring.
Who was that?
Kenzie.
Doug Scoggins.
Doug Scoggins.
Yeah. I remember now.
He sat on the front row the next week.
Yeah.
And Spadborn had the gimmick on you with fingers, put it on your neck.
Yeah, the nerve hole.
And the ring. Yeah,
I remember now. Yeah.
And him and Steinborn went at it. You just walked right on out the ring.
Yeah.
Let me tell you this. One time we would come back to Savannah. Jody was driving. We drove about 15 miles. I'm laying down in the back seat. Him and Junior riding up in front seat. He said, I'm tired. You don't drive? I said, no, I'm tired, too. He said, Nick says, I'll drive. I jumped right up right there, and I said, no, I'll drive. I was about 13 years old.
Well, that brings up another story, Jody, I want to get from the horse's mouth. Bobby's told the story on here about the time Zulu fell asleep in the back seat of your car, and you kind of pulled a rib on him, if you remember that.
Did it have something to do with a pistol?
No. We were going to Savannah, and he had broke his wrist, and he was making all the towns. I was riding with you. Me and you were in the front seat. You were driving, and he went to sleep, and he laid down in the back seat, and he had his feet up. His feet weren't in the seat, but he was facing the back of the car, but his feet were up on the seat. And you seen him. And you made me buckle the seatbelt, and you left that seat up as far as you could, and you hollered, oh, God, a deer, and hit the brakes. And he
came off
the back seat, into the floorboard, and then you tooled that seat back. And he couldn't get up.
Yeah. I can't remember who was with me the night. We're coming out of Statesboro. And you remember Crazy Luke?
Yep.
And I told Crazy, and Luke, he was rather fond of the spirits.
What's it like?
He was into the cups pretty good by the time he left the arena. And I told him, I said, well, be careful. I said, there's a lot of livestock on the road. He said, yeah, I will. About 40 miles up the road and everything, you see all these blinking lights and all that and everything. He'd run over about a 400-pound hog that had demolished his car. He said, ah, hell, I couldn't see him. Oh, God.
Guys, we are out of time. Jody, before we go, though, you mentioned your book, and I was going to get this plug in anyway. Jody, with the help of Scott Thiel, and it's published through Crowbar Press, wrote a book a few years back called Behind the Mask. And if you have not read it, and you can't call yourself a true wrestling fan if you have not read this book, go buy it tomorrow.
Yeah, very good book.
Whatever you got to do, get that book, because this is one of the best books I've ever read. And,
yeah, you can. Anybody that wants to get it, all they got to do is just go on the internet and www.crowbarpress.com, and it'll be right there.
Right. Fantastic book.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you.
And very good. And Jody, it has been an honor having you on here. We got to get you on here again.
Well, yeah. Just let me know. Just give me a shout anytime.
I will do so, and I will pass your phone number along to Bill Bowman, because I'm sure he'd love to talk to you, because he wanted to be on here tonight. But Alex said somebody must have called him or something, and he dropped off. But
yeah,
again, I appreciate you doing the show, Joe Turner, Charlie Smith. Happy birthday, Charlie. Appreciate
Thank
you guys
you,
calling in.
Is this your birthday, you old senile
tomorrow,
fool?
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow. All right.
It'll be 83 for the seventh time tomorrow.
Oh, God. All the girls think I'm about
You're going to be 83 19. Years ugly.
So all the girls think I'm about 18 or 19 old.
Yeah, well,
yeah.
I remember that magnificent body you had when you were refereeing and everything. You looked like a poster child for tuberculosis. All right, guys.
All right,
appreciate you having me on.
Good night,
thank you, sir.
Thank you, Jody.
Take care.
Bye
bye.
Next week, we will be joined by Terry Lawler, who will discuss the upcoming third annual tribute to Ted Allen, the Nightmare Tour Remember 3. And the following week, Scott Thiel will be our special guest. And then we'll take a week off for the reunion. And after that, I'm not sure, because I got a call from Ronnie West today saying we may be starting the circus a week ahead of schedule, so I may be on the road shortly after reunion, so I'm going to leave the week after the Mobile reunion, that week opens. At this point, say it's planning anything, because I'm not sure where I'll be, but if I'm not traveling, we'll certainly have a show. But we've got things lined up for the next 2 weeks, so everybody that's listening to us, be sure and tune in next week, and we'll do this again. And this was a great show, guys. I'm glad we finally got Jody on with us.
Yeah, good show.
All right, well, guys, I will talk to you guys next Thursday, and we'll do this again. Thank
Sounds
you, guys.
Good. Good night, guys.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.
For listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.